Cool. If everyone could have Bibles, that would be brilliant, just because we're going to be sort of looking through the passage in a bit of detail. It'd be really useful if we could have them to hand, just so we can follow them through. So the passage we're doing today is John 18, and that can be found on page number 1086. So that's John 18, and we're going to go verses 1 to 11. I don't know about you, but every now and again, when I go to the cinema, I might have had too much Coca-Cola to drink, or, I don't know, a hot day like this, too much water. I need to pop to the toilet, and I'm always really worried that I'm going to miss a good bit. So I've got to kind of, like, guess whether I'm, like, leaving a good bit or a kind of quiet bit. You always come back and sort of say, whisper to the person next to you, like, did I miss a good bit? What happened? And I've had friends do it in the past, and usually it's sort of like, no, you didn't miss anything good. But occasionally, maybe if you want to wind them up, you sort of say, no, see, you missed a really good bit. It all kicked off while you're out of the toilet. It was a really good bit. I kind of feel like maybe that's a bit today. Obviously, people at Focus and away on holiday, and they're missing the bit where it all kicks off in John's Gospel. Been working through it now, and now we're on chapter 18. And this is the bit where, following all Jesus' wonderful teaching and deeds, it all begins to kick off. At the arrest. So I'll read the passage and then we'll look at three things. I'm going to try and draw out this passage. Okay, so from verse 1. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place, because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas, the traitor, was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Who is it that you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. "If you are looking for me, then let these men go." This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant's ear, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink from the cup the Father has given me?" Okay, so there are three things we're going to look at here, and they're kind of things that kind of echo through John's Gospel. The first point that we're going to look at is that at this point in the story, the whole world is against Jesus. The second point is that despite this, Jesus is still in control and he allows it to happen. And the third point is that Jesus drinks from the cup that is given to him. Are you willing to drink from the cup the Father gives to you? So three points, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about some background detail, just looking at the other Gospels as well, and the arrest accounts in that, just so we've got some understanding of what's going on here and how John portrays it. So, first of all, just a little bit of background. So in the other gospel accounts of the arrest of Jesus, I'm trying to think, can you guys remember what happened in Gethsemane? What are the kind of key moments in Gethsemane? There'd probably be two that you'd mention. Number one would be the disciples falling asleep when they're supposed to pray. And the other one would be Jesus' agony and anguish as he prays by himself. Now, it's interesting in this passage, we have verse 1 in 18, where they go to the Kidron Valley, over to Gethsemane and they're praying. And then it's sort of verse 2 focuses on Judas and they return to Jesus. So John doesn't include that section of the story where the disciples let Jesus down and where Jesus is in anguish and agony. And it's really curious. I think it follows sort of Judas sort of point of view and then it switches to Jesus. I wonder why this might be. Well, I think first of all, the most obvious answer is that the audience that John is giving his gospel to already know about Jesus' anguish. They already know about how Jesus' disciples fell asleep and let him down. They fell asleep and let him down when he needed them most. So they already know that. And second of all, I think that John really wants to give Jesus' perspective on all this. So whereas in the other gospels, so Matthew, Mark and Luke, they're called the Synoptic Gospels, so I might refer to them as the Synoptic Gospels, but those three, it kind of gives the disciples sort of perspective. So the disciples probably afterwards feel pretty guilty about the fact that when Jesus needed them most, when he went away to pray before his crucifixion, they fell asleep, they let him down, and then ultimately they ran away. They probably felt pretty guilty about it. It's probably really etched into their minds. And so I think that's why the Synoptic Gospels focus on that. I think John really wants to look at what is Jesus thinking through all this? What is Jesus' perspective? And this is where we'll come on to the next two points, that Jesus is completely in control. But I just want to say that although we've kind of contrasted the Gospels there, it's more about perspective rather than contradiction. Certainly the description of what happened in the Synoptic Gospels would have come in verse 2. John doesn't say anything that contradicts that. He just sort of doesn't include it because he knows his audience already knows about it. And we'll see later on in the talk that actually John sort of refers back to that anguish that Jesus suffered in the garden. So, first point. The whole world is against Jesus. So we're going to look at verse 3. And I'll read it out to you. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. Right, so one of the big, probably really difficult aspects with Christian tradition is that a lot of the time, very sadly, Jewish people have been blamed for the death of Jesus. And you'll actually find this, people even sometimes highlight John's gospel as a kind of proof of this or an example of this. Well, in John's gospel, actually, throughout, he sort of really does emphasize it's the whole world against Jesus at this point. The whole world put him to death. So he does it previously in John 1, verse 10. So that's where he talks about Jesus came into the world. So he's talking about Jesus as the Word. And he says, he was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. So there's no mention of specific groups of people. It's the world that did not recognize him. And then later on, in the crucifixion, in John 19:20, Jesus is nailed to the cross and the charges against him are nailed above. And it says, this is Jesus, King. This, I think it says, the King of the Jews. And they write it in Latin, Aramaic and Greek. They write it in three languages just to show how much, you know, just the breadth of people that are against Jesus, that are charging people. So Jesus' death is very much against the world. Now, verse 3, you might be saying, how do they show these people? We see the Jewish leaders, the officials that were sent from the chief priests and the Pharisees. But you see also here this group of soldiers. Now, who were soldiers from? Soldiers would have been the Roman ruling authority. So we have the Jewish people. We also have Gentiles coming here to capture and arrest Jesus. See, one of the big propaganda kind of like, I mean, say perhaps lies or things that are kind of like exposed in the Gospels is this idea that you may have heard of called the Pax Romana. Has anyone heard of that before? Yeah. Basically, it translates as Roman peace. And the Romans promised that when they occupied a country, so in this case, Judea, that although they might conquer it and rule it and be oppressed at times, that there would be peace. There would be justice. There wouldn't be infighting. The Romans would rule with peace. But here we see The people that promise that they will give peace are involved in this squabble and are arresting Jesus, the most loving man ever. They're arresting him. They're going to have him put to death on a Roman cross. Reminded me of a little bit of what's been happening in America. I think one of the scary things is, I think that the motto for, I don't know if it's all sort of state police, but it's protect and serve, I believe. I haven't been to America, so I might not know, but I know that protect and serve is one of the big ideals they live up to. And we see lots of cases of black people being victimized and shot by the very people that are supposed to protect them and serve them. How scary is that? It's really terrifying to think that the people that are supposed to be looking after you, making sure that your welfare is good and, you know, everything's okay and providing justice, they're the ones you've got to hide from. You've got to fear because they might kill you. A really terrifying thought to be in that situation where maybe there's been some problems, some issues between a neighbour or whatever, and suddenly the police are coming in. You think they're going to be the people that are going to bring justice and protect and serve you, and they're the people you're going to fear the most because you do not know what's going to happen. Real injustice. And this is what Jesus is faced with here. Real injustice. The very people that offer this Pax Romana, this Roman peace, are working with the officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees to take him away and to arrest him. Said the whole world. Now, a lot of people back in the first century talked of two races. They talked of the Jewish race and the Gentile race. But then another race came on the scene, so-called race, ideas from the first century. The Christians, where did they? Because they didn't quite fit into either. And I think it's really interesting that in this verse 3, we see Judas, one of the disciples, one of the people that Jesus had chosen himself, working against Jesus, betraying him, leading these people to take him to his death. Even the people he'd chosen from his inner circle, as his inner circle of friends, is going to betray him and lead him to this. I mean, what is going to be quite an awful ordeal. So there we have it. The officials, chief priests and Pharisees, the Jews, the soldiers from Rome, and also Judas from amongst his disciples. The whole world is against Jesus. But point two, despite the whole world being against him, Jesus is still in control and still lays down his life. Now, Jesus is in Gethsemane, and I just think it's really important to point out at this point, this isn't Jesus hiding. We've seen in the news in the past 10 years or so, Colonel Gaddafi, when everything went wrong and he realised he was in trouble, he went and hid, and I think he hid in a drain or somewhere under a bridge. He went away and hid because he knew what was going to happen. Saddam Hussein, I think, went back to his hometown and hid in a hole or a well because he knew that things had fallen apart around him and he was in trouble. Now, Jesus, although things are falling apart around him, the whole world is against him, Jesus does not hide. When he retreats to Gethsemane, he's not hiding away. In fact, when he sees the people with the weapons, torch and lanterns coming, Jesus stands out and boldly says to them, "Who do you want?" And when they tell him they want Jesus of Nazareth, he says, "I am he." Now, I am. Can you remember the I am sayings of John's gospel? Cast our minds back over the past year and a half. What have we got? Who can anyone remember them? It's the bread. I've got them written down here. Shout out if you can remember any. No? Okay. I am the bread of life. The vine. The gate. Yes. The light of the world. The good shepherd. The resurrection and the life. And finally, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So here Jesus shows how essential he is for spiritual life and spiritual well-being. And he chooses this way of saying it, I am. And again, when they're questioned, who is, you know, Jesus of Nazareth, he says, I am he. Now in the Greek, they don't need that he word. That's kind of like, if you think about it, it's kind of irrelevant. He just says, I am. He sort of like nods back to these previous sayings. And you may remember in John 8, verse 58, Jesus says, he's getting into a dispute with the Pharisees, and he says, before Abraham, I am. So before even the founder of Judaism, Abraham, Jesus was there from the beginning. And we know from John's gospel that Jesus was not there only from the beginning, but actually the whole world was created through him. He's essential for creation. And the passage that it refers back to most is Exodus 3. So I don't know if anyone would like to look at that passage. I'll quickly read it out. Don't want to go into too much detail on it, but it's just really useful background information. So Exodus 3 and verse 13. So Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are set to say to the Israelites. I am has sent you. God said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. So already this I am is an ancient phrase that reminds Israel of their history, their past, where God has been in control, led them through the wilderness, led them out of slavery, and at this point delivered them a Messiah that they don't realise is God yet. The I am phrase, I'll tell you what it is. So when he says the Lord, I don't know if you guys know the name for the Lord in Hebrew. It's pronounced, or they think it's pronounced, and I'll say it quietly because Jews don't like it to be pronounced, but I'll say it. It's Yahweh. Now, in Hebrew, I am is Ehyeh. So you can already hear how similar it is. Yahweh, Ehyeh. So when God says, I am who I am, it's a Ehyeh, Asher, Ehyeh. He's really sort of like using a play on words with the word for Lord, the word for God, the special word they have for the God of Israel. I am who I am. It sounds quite strange. I mean, I don't know. It's a very difficult passage to understand what it means by I am who I am. And I think there's a lot of, you know, sort of references, but there are two meanings I think that are relevant here. And I think that Jesus is referring to. So first of all, I am who I am could mean I will be who I want to be. I will do what I want to do. And it's a sign of God's divine freedom. God can show himself in whatever way he chooses. God can reveal himself in whatever way he chooses. And in this case, God is revealing himself through the person of Jesus and through this terrible crucifixion and crucifixion that will ultimately lead to resurrection and redemption for the whole of mankind. So God is choosing to reveal himself how he chooses to reveal himself. And the second meaning is a bit broader. It sort of means being in a more general sense. So it reminds us of Jesus's being at the start of creation when the whole world is created for him, but through him rather. It reminds us that he is essential for the being, for the fabric of the world, and he holds the creation in existence. And so when Jesus says, I am, when questioned, he's reminding us that he will choose to reveal himself how he wants. And he's also reminding us that he has been there from the start of creation and that he holds it in existence. Jesus is in control no matter what. So then the sort of contingent fall back, they draw back and fall down. And I'm not sure whether this is like just because they see Jesus' divine power and they just collapse, whether it's because they see how bold he is. They're expecting someone hiding in a drain, hiding in a kind of like a hole in his hometown. And boldly he comes out and says, I am he, I am Jesus of Nazareth. And I think probably at that point they'd be quite scared to think, does this guy have some weapons? Is he gonna murder us here? Does he know something we don't know? And they kind of run away and fall down. Potentially it could be either, but certainly they're shocked by how boldly he speaks up. And this is where Jesus really does walk the walk. There are a lot of people that talk. I don't know if anyone here watches boxing or mixed martial arts, but you get a lot of people. There was a guy, Colin McGregor, who whenever he went on TV, he was bigging it up, saying, what, like 10 minutes? I'm going to, like, it's really hard to listen to because he bigs himself up so much. And then he got beaten pretty badly. I think he got his comeuppance a bit. And a lot of boxers who are like, you know, third round, I'm going to take you down. And it really doesn't happen. If anyone watches YouTube, there's a video on YouTube of a guy dancing into the ring, like literally dancing into the ring. And I think he lasts about 10 seconds. Jesus is not like those people that talk the talk and fall short when they're badly needed. He's not like, I don't know, politicians or whatever that promise a lot and then when it comes down to the crunch, really don't give it. Jesus said, I will lay down my life for my sheep, John 10. He said, I will not let this hour pass from me, John 12, 27. And when this hour does come, despite what we know about his previous anguish, his previous agony, he walks the walk. He said, I'm here. Let it happen. He goes through with it. Jesus fulfills and keeps his promises. He did it then. And importantly, he will do it now for you. So, finally, the third point. Verse 11. Shall I not drink from the cup the Father has given me? And this is a reference to the synoptic. So you remember I told you that those kind of details were kind of like left out by John. But actually, that's what Jesus says in the synoptics. In Mark, Luke, and Matthew, he says, is there a way this cup can be taken from me? Is there any way? I know that everything's possible with you. But ultimately, God, I will do what you want. And here he says to Peter, after Peter's kind of interjected, trying to break it and stop it, giving Jesus a way out, giving him a chance to escape, he says, shall I not drink from the Father, the cup the Father has given me? He's determined to go through with what he has to do. I think the image here of a cup is apparently something that contains something really bitter, so pretty horrible to drink. Reminded of when my brother was young, he was saying he was ill. We had to give him some medicine. He really didn't like it. It was not very nice, but ultimately it would make him better in the long run. I think this is kind of on a grander scale like that, a really bitter cup, something that's not pleasant to drink for Jesus, because he is ultimately going to suffer really awfully. He's going to go through a really unpleasant 24 hours. But with determination, even when he's offered a chance out, a way out from Peter, he says, no, am I not going to drink the cup that the Father has given me? Are we in this room today willing to drink from the cup the Father has given us? You see, Jesus takes the short-term suffering. He allows himself to die and be buried so that we could live again. And in fact, you see that Jesus lays down his life and lets his disciple go. He says, take me, but don't take these ones. Let my disciples go. Are we willing to go through that short-term suffering? Because that's the cup that the Father is giving us. Perhaps it's a task that God has sort of imprinted on your heart, something that you think you ought to do and you think you're kind of working towards, but it's getting tough. Remember here, Jesus is our example, our Redeemer. He drank from that bitter cup. He drank the cup even when the whole world was against him, even when he knew that there was going to be awful things ahead. And I was thinking of perhaps how we might be able to drink from that cup when we don't have a kind of clear sort of vision from God, but we are just living our day-to-day lives. What kind of cups are offered to us, bitter cups that we don't want to have to drink, but as Christians we have to? And I was reminded, there's a clip from a film that I've seen. I haven't actually seen the whole film, I've just seen this clip. And it's people sitting in a boardroom, and they're sort of really, basically this guy comes in and they're chatting and they're sort of slating different members in this kind of profile of the company. And then the guy walks out, and as soon as he's walked out, he's like, do you like that guy? He's like, are you kidding? I hate him. And I think a lot of the time, I was talking to Helen about what it's like at work sometimes. There really is that kind of like, I don't know, like slander. It's like talking behind people's backs that goes on. And as Christians, if we don't take part in that, if we sort of avoid it, we may end up receiving it ourselves. When we walk out the room, we'll be the ones that they talk about. And that can be a bitter cup to swallow. Like, no one wants to be talked about negatively amongst their colleagues. But I think that's just an example of the kind of cup that we're often asked to drink. Jesus drank from the cup. He boldly said, with great determination, am I not going to drink from the cup the Father has given me? And I encourage you today to think about the cup that Jesus has given you, the Father has given to you, and think about how you can drink it yourselves and how God can strengthen you while you drink it. In the name of God.